Heavy networking by the Packet Pushers is sponsored today by IT Pro TV. Visit itpro.tv/packet to save an additional 25% off your membership for the lifetime of your active subscription. Just be sure to use the code PACKET25 at checkout. That's PACKET25. And we thank them for sponsoring the podcast.
This episode is sponsored in part by Thousand Eyes. Thousand Eyes gives you visibility, insights, and actionable intelligence into user experience from every user to every application over any network. So you transform your WAN, troubleshoot faster, and deliver exceptional user experiences in the cloud and on premises. Try Thousand Eyes for free at thousandeyes.com/packetpushers and snag a fun t-shirt. Thousand Eyes. Thrive in a connected world.
Welcome to Packet Pushers, the greatest data networking podcast so far in the world today. Now, today, I want to come back to the topic of future of networking. You know, the future of networking series is where we get to somebody who's been around the industry for quite a bit of time and start to delve into their expertise, their experience, and sort of try and look at where we've come from, because everything that we do in technology is a part of where we come from, and then where we're going to. And the goal is to try and look 5 years into the future, not 6 weeks into the future. It's easy to predict. Try and look five or even further out and talk about big topics and big issues and try and surface ideas to help you make decisions about the strategy in your network, about the products that you buy, and to think differently about life. Today, my guest is Harry Quackerboss. And rather than me introducing, why don't you introduce yourself, Harry, and welcome to the Packet Pushers.
Thank you, Greg. I appreciate the opportunity.
And you and I have been stumbling into each other for many years now. I've had the privilege of, you know, traveling around the place, and you keep popping up in my Twitter feed, and we throw some commentary backwards and forwards. So I'm really pleased to have you on the show. So tell people what have you been doing for the last 20, 30 years?
I started writing software and did a combination of embedded design process control type software, and also worked at the other extreme with really high-end time sharing, and was involved with an operating system named Multics for several years when I worked with Honeywell, which was kind of the godfather of Unix and Linux, evangelized relational databases. I actually won an ACM award for a presentation at a regional conference for that work, and went from there to getting involved in TCP/IP networking quite early. In the mid-80s, was evangelizing TCP/IP for private networks.
Ah, the era of everyone was inventing their own protocol.
Indeed.
The very opposite of today, where everybody just says, can't we just use TLS for everything?
We actually did a pretty cool project. When I was involved with the Multics project, we ended up collaborating with Cray to use a Network Systems Corporation hyperchannel, which in the early 80s was a blindingly fast intra-computer room technology to connect mostly mainframes together, but it operated at 100 megabits a second, and round numbers was 100,000 a link.
Yeah.
And so people were interested in using the Multics system as sort of a data management facility and job scheduler for the Cray. And so we convinced the Royal Aircraft Establishment in Farnborough, England, to use this brand new protocol called TCP/IP. And so the Multics system was at MIT was very early on the internet, one of the first five nodes. And so we had FTP, Telnet, and could submit jobs from the Multics to the Cray. And then we have subsequently sold that same combination to Ford Motor Company, General Motors, a few other places. But morphing ahead, I stayed in high-end computing for much of my early career. And then I ended up as VP of sales of Crescendo Communications, which was the first company Cisco bought. And so heavily into networking.
So you parlayed your high-speed interconnect into high-speed Ethernet, because Crescendo was making, what was high-speed Ethernet switches of the era?
Originally FDDI over copper, CDDI, we sold a fair amount of interconnect, including desktop FDDI. Sun Microsystems, for example, we sold 3,000 connections to Spark Technology.
I loved FDDI. I loved FDDI back in the day. I still think we missed a trick by not going with FDDI in the long run for many reasons.
I'm sure there are people, but who agree with you. I think ultimately Ethernet wins, and it's continuing to win.
Well, I think Ethernet always wins because it's cheap, And the thing that we've learned in IT infrastructure is that cheap to buy and cheap to get started with always wins over long-term operational hassle. FTDI was expensive to buy and difficult to get started, but once you were through that, it was very cheap to run infinitely. And what we know is that customers are generally dumb and they can't see through the initial purchase price to see the cheaper operational stuff in the longer term.
There's an apocryphal story in America about George Washington, called the father of the nation, who the apocryphal story is when he was a kid, he chopped down a cherry tree on his father's farm and his father was cross with him, but he fessed up to being the one who had chopped down the cherry tree. And so the story is this farmer in Virginia, in the hills of Virginia, has somehow managed to acquire and keep through generations this original hatchet used to chop down the cherry tree. And of course, the handle's been changed 5 times and it's on its 3rd head, but it's the original hatchet. And I sort of feel that way about Ethernet. They kept a basic frame format in the name, but it's certainly...
Yeah. I enjoyed FTDI for a fairly simple reason, that I was working for a reseller and I would be quite often going out to Ethernet backbones of the era that had FTDI rings in the core. And in the middle of the day, you know, anytime, peak time, off time, I could break the FTDI ring and add a new building. So you'd have this big FTDI ring around all the campus sites. And then you just walk up, you want to plug in a new campus building, you'd rack everything up, patch up all the Ethernet. Then you just break the FTDI ring, unplug, replug, and boom, you're connected. None of this Ethernet silliness around spanning tree and loops and bridging and collapsing all the time and all that. So FTDI just took care of all of that. And if one of the switches went down, it didn't stop working. The FTDI looped and then away it went. It did the neighbor, all done at layer 2, all transparently to the user, it was a little difficult to troubleshoot sometimes when something disappeared off the network and you had to go and find it. But other than that, be far superior to Ethernet in every practical measure. And even today, we're still trying to make Ethernet look like FTDI with counter-rotating rings and redundancy and path detection there, you know, keep alive between neighbors like LLDP to say what is it that the neighbor's doing, all that sort of stuff. I do feel like we keep reinventing the wheel. If we only had selected a round wheel with an axle in the middle, we might be a lot better off.
So some of this, in fact, is sort of accidental. Yeah. But you talk about rings there, and we can get back and I can finish the story about my career. But one of the things about rings, and it's true whether you're talking about very small things on chips, is that in a sense, if you start out, if you think about a bus as the most simple interconnect for gadgets, chips, boxes, whatever, the next step up is to connect the end of the bus and you have a ring. And so then you can go to counter-rotating rings. But one of the phenomena about rings is, from a bandwidth standpoint, the mass says beyond about a few nodes, less than 10.
Yeah,
the shared bandwidth gets to be an issue. But the other thing is, as a practical matter, as you talked about, if you want to do software upgrades and you take things out of service, you can tolerate one outage, but you can't tolerate multiples. And so one of the ways Crescendo, actually, their first product was quite successful, was selling redundant dual home concentrators underneath routers. It's a fairly easy sales pitch, and Crescendo had a very good product for that.
Yeah, well, if we had have switched FTDI in the long run, we would have, as you say, switched FTDI took away the weaknesses for the looping.
And no question, the Crescendo team could have built an outstanding low-cost FTDI switch, but they chose to go Ethernet.
I think Cisco went with the easy way out there in the end. They bought Crescendo and then they bought Calpana, and the Ethernet switches were cheaper and people weren't looking for scale. They were looking for quick wins for the easy way out, and we went with Ethernet. And I think in the end, Cisco is a company which likes to focus on a limited number of things. It always wanted people to do TCP/IP. Mm-hmm. It always wanted to just be Ethernet, TCP/IP, and some routing on top. And that was all it wanted to do in that era. And that focus let them make it easy for salespeople to go out there and bash customers to death over a single story, whereas other companies were out there telling stories of Token Ring and FTDI and all the different protocols that were going on at the era, and it was all very confusing. Whereas Cisco was going, no, what you really just want is Ethernet and TCP/IP, and that's for the future.
Of course, the other two switching companies you mentioned, Calpana, they also bought Grand Junction, founded by Howard Charney and several of the other 3Com founders, and Granite Systems, founded by Andy Bechtolsheim and David Chardon.
It's funny, isn't it, that Andy Bechtolsheim's now founded Arista, is doing it all over again.
Yep. Very successfully, obviously.
Yeah. Well, I find it interesting that, and I wonder what your thoughts are on this, which is Arista is kind of doing Cisco better than Cisco. So it's doing products which are roughly similar to Cisco, but better than Cisco can for in various dimensions. They're not perfect, but and good enough for to attract a certain substantial amount of business.
I think that's correct. Without dumbing it down, a protege sales rep of me who was selling against them, he sort of described Arista as Cisco Lite a few years ago. But the interesting thing to me about Arista is they're using mostly off-the-shelf silicon. I don't think, actually think they're doing any of their own chips, but their product margins are quite substantial. And it's very impressive that they can do that. And I think the collective wisdom was it was impossible to do that sort of thing with those margins. In fact, what they've turned out to be quite successful.
Well, I think the partnership with Broadcom, they also did some early moves to play off the other ASIC makers. But because they unified, so Arista's value is that they have one single software image and then multiple hardware platforms underneath. And I think Cisco's challenge was probably because they were working at scale and also historically because John Chambers set up a company where Cisco was so dominant in the networking market, the way that he's organized Cisco of the era to be competitive, to stay competitive, not get fat and lazy like other competitors, was to adopt the business model that General Electric did, which was where he put the different business units in the company to compete against each other. So you have the CAT 4500, the CAT 6000, the Nexus product, you know, all those product lines. And those sales reps will go out there and compete for customers. And that kept the theory was that the company stayed healthy because if any one business unit tripped up or failed, there was another business unit to make sure that they dominated the market on the whole.
That's right. Turns out Scott McNeely, a little younger than I am, but he and I grew up, did not know each other, but grew up kind of in the same industry. I grew up in Detroit. My dad ran market research for General Motors in the 70s. And so I became sort of a student of how GM organized. And so GM was built as a set of business units and in fact did 100 acquisitions through vertical integration. And some of that same thing, you know, where you have a committee that sort of adjudicates turf wars among the various car lines. They abandoned that, I think, to their detriment. But I think GE was to some extent modeled on DuPont and General Motors. But you're absolutely right. I think it was a model that worked very well. Eventually, you get to the point where the internal competition is more serious than the outside, and so you go through these oscillating cycles about how much you do that, and they've done a bunch of consolidation.
Yeah,
I think so.
Yeah, it doesn't like any business fashion. It doesn't last forever before the negatives start to outweigh the positives. And I think through up until the early to the mid 2000s, it was a fine model. But as other networking companies started to get their quality levels up, and Cisco wasn't able to compete, and you know we saw Juniper thrive to a larger or lesser extent. But I think perhaps at the end, the collapse of that was when most of the other competitors disappeared. The model was shown to be hollow, and especially the arrival of white box, when anybody could buy a switch from a white box at a fraction of the price. People would look, just the sales reps would come up and say, well, hey, you know, I've got 15, 30, 20 different families of switches. Which one do you want? And they go like, that's very confusing. I think I'll just buy something nice and simple. I'll buy away. I'll look at for a simpler buy. I would just, yeah, it made sense in its era. I think the era passed.
So I, after Cisco, I ended up being involved in several startups, most recently Woven Systems in the mid 2000s. Mm-hmm. Which ultimately was acquired by Fortinet, and some of the Woven technology ended up in I think high end Fortinet products. I also did a blade server project with one of the major Taiwan ODMs in the early 2000s, which was an eye opening experience. The cost structure of the Asian systems companies, where they operate the entire company on single digit gross margins. Quite interesting. And kind of early in my career, I'm a serious motorsports enthusiast, and actually took a side track from my technology career to work for a company founded by John DeLorean, which is a whole nother story in itself early on. But more recently, I've been working in a variety of projects with mostly startups, some companies larger in the area of strategy, planning, financing, fundraising, and so forth. Mm. And most of that has involved data center infrastructure.
Yep.
Including a pretty deep dive into OpenStack and Kubernetes and how to build private clouds and clouds for smaller service providers.
Yeah, the thing about Woven Systems, which is what drew you to my attention, was that Woven Systems was one of the early high-speed Ethernet, so 10 gig Ethernet, along with the Force 10 of the era. You and Force 10 competed head-to-head for quite some time, I believe.
In fact, yeah, we in 2007, when we launched our product, it was actually with 144 10 gig ports. It was the largest data center 10 gig switch available. And it was interesting times. And I think, you know, if you look at the history of Ethernet, 10 gig was kind of an inflection point because it broke this 5 to 7 year upgrade cycle for Ethernet, where 10 meg, 100 meg gig followed this nice 5 to 7 year progression, which actually correlates to about a 10x improvement in Moore's law. But between the 2000 era, you know, one, everybody built early in anticipation of the 2000 date problem, if you remember that.
Yeah, it brought a lot of sales, a lot of investment was pulled forward.
And so that plus the implosion of simultaneously the telecom implosion and the dot-com implosion meant that there was a pretty serious drought right as the 10 gig transition happened. Silicon changes came along. A bunch of the companies that came out with 10 gig for server connectivity products early didn't survive because they didn't have the funds to do yet another spin of their design to take advantage of the next generation process technology. And of course, the switching bottlenecks for quite a while until I think, you know, Fulcrum Microsystems had a layer 2 switch chip ultimately acquired by Intel, but it took Broadcom a while to come out with a high enough density 10 gig Ethernet switch to make the switching cost as low as the adapter cost. So that transition, I think, was somewhat spread out compared to the earlier ones.
Yeah, it was interesting that in the mid 2000s, nobody really wanted 10 gig. And we also had the impact of VMware, where they use different 1 gig ports for everything. So they'd have 2 1 gigs for the management and 2 1 gigs for the vMotion tech activity. They'd have 2 1 gigs for the data, and some systems would have 12 1 gig Ethernet ports, and each one was dedicated to a single task. And that was kind of a cost strategy of the era to make sure that there was enough bandwidth available.
Mm-hmm.
And convincing customers to buy 10 gig interfaces was almost impossible. And none of the vendors wanted to make 10 gig, even though it would have made sense, because nobody trusted Ethernet to be stable and reliable. That is to be, you know, you couldn't quass it and guarantee that vMotion wouldn't saturate the bandwidth and then crush everything else on the box, and then it would collapse and die.
So now you're on the edge of an interesting point. So there's a computer architecture book by John Hennessy, former president of Stanford and founder of MIPS, and his colleague at Berkeley, David Patterson, who coined the term RISC, R-I-S-C. So they wrote a book on computer architecture, multiple revisions. So I think it's the front cover. If you open up the front cover, there is a little note, among other things, there's a little note about Amdahl's rule of thumb. So Amdahl's known for Amdahl's law, which has to do with scaling of shared memory systems. But he also had this lesser known sort of rule of thumb, which about for a balanced system, where he said a balanced systems for every instruction needs one byte of memory and one bit of I/O. So to translate that, a one MIPS computer needed a megabit per second of I/O and a megabyte of RAM.
Okay.
A 1 gigahertz system, same thing, a gigabyte of RAM, a gigabit per second of bandwidth. There are a couple things sort of broke this, but it's kind of an aside. If you remember, going way back, there was a point in time when Andy Bechtolsheim at Sun was advocating diskless workstation. Failed. But his notion was you take the disk out of the desktop and you over 10 meg Ethernet, you can boot the system. So everybody ended up putting disk backs in the workstation because the performance wasn't very good. But
was also the era where they said the computer is the network is the computer, and that was the point was the disks weren't in the workstations; they're actually back in the servers.
That's right.
But the network really wasn't. I think in the long run, it was a good idea, but again, we didn't have the stable campus networks and the performance available to deliver that, I felt. A lot of those Java.
That's exactly right. Yeah. But although the modern incarnation, VDI, virtual desktops, still is a kind of a challenge for most organizations. It hasn't been broadly adopted. But part of what broke this kind of rule of thumb was for the organizations that would have been likely candidates for 10 gig E, Brocade was being very successful promoting Fibre Channel for storage. So part of the bandwidth that went outside the server was going to Fibre Channel. And in fact, the high cost impacted. So that's why this is not a law. This really is just a rule of thumb. The high cost of building out 10 gig infrastructure.
That's okay. Moore's law isn't a rule. It's just a rule of thumb. It's not a law.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed. But this is kind of for years and years, there'd been debate about which comes first, the hardware or the software. My opinion, the hardware is kind of the enabler. And in an application of Parkinson's law, which has to do about bureaucracy sort of expanding, I think kind of applies to computer. You build a gadget and people will figure out how to consume the resource that's available in the gadget. So
let's pause the podcast for a moment to tell you about today's sponsor, Thousand Eyes. Like it or not, your organization is embracing the cloud, and that might be great for the business, but for network architects and IT ops teams, it can be a service delivery nightmare. Why? Well, you're depending on cloud providers, ISPs, and third-party apps for business-critical services. And even though you don't control those networks, you do own the service delivery, which means if performance is bad, people are going to come looking for you. And this is where ThousandEyes can help. You can take advantage of ThousandEyes agents across the cloud, within your enterprise, all the way down to the endpoint. These agents actively monitor network behavior and topologies and how they affect application performance. With ThousandEyes, you can correlate multiple layers of performance data from L2 to L7, including BGP routing and DNS, to quickly identify problem areas and dramatically reduce your mean time to repair. You can pinpoint the root cause of device faults, congestion, Wi-Fi quality, DDoS attacks, and more. And you don't have to keep all this intelligence to yourself. You can easily share events, metrics, and dashboards with your vendors and customers so that you can collaborate to resolve problems faster. Now, ThousandEyes also aggregates anonymized real-time data from a collective data set so they can generate insights about large-scale issues across the internet, including their severity and breadth, as well as likely root cause. Now, if all that sounds good to you, here's a special offer for Packet Pushers listeners. Try ThousandEyes for free at thousandeyes.com/packetpushers. And while you're there, get yourself a free ThousandEyes t-shirt. That's thousandeyes.com/packetpushers. Manage every network like it's your own. ThousandEyes. Thrive in a connected world. And now, back to the podcast.
So you mentioned this hardware and software thing, and I think this is still an issue that a lot of people haven't heard of, so I want to touch on it. And for the last, three decades in networking, the hardware and software came integrated as a single bundle. And then there was an attempt to unbundle it. So we saw white box and the rise of companies selling software. And then, that was the disaggregation. And I think what we're actually seeing now, disaggregation or unbundling is another word. I'll use unbundling because of what I want to talk about now is we're seeing a rebundling. So we've seen Cisco sort of pretty much reject the idea of unbundling network devices. They still sell the hardware and the software. They're using more open-ish software. That is, they're using Linux and so on, containers and stuff like that. But you can't run Cisco software on white boxes unless you're a very special organization that can convince Cisco to sell you that particular product. It does do it. It's just very limited distribution. Is that bundling and rebundling, is that necessary? Do you think we're seeing much more software networking, or is it always going to be hardware software?
I do not know, but I think this is going to be a segue into kind of the what's going on with NFV, because there's been a lot of discussion recently about really what are the issues. And I think I was really struck the first time I looked at Oracle's IPO filing, their S1 document, and I was like floored to see that they spent 53% of their income on sales and marketing. And the thing that's kind of lost with open source is, one, it costs money to evangelize positions and get customers to actually adopt it. That's the first problem. And it's the one that I think is talked about the least, But the second part of the problem is now pretty well understood. An open source project requires somebody to support it. Now, bigger organizations can take on that responsibility. It turns into a lifestyle. When there's an issue, they'll do a Google search on the error message or the syndrome, and they'll, you know, find some module, try it out, patch it. It's a different lifestyle from what happens if you get support from VMware or Oracle. And it works for some organizations, and the cost is, people are, I think, more aware of it than they were 10 years ago, but it's still very, very hard to track and isolate. And so I think there still is an underappreciation for how much of the cost of proprietary software is, in fact, the customer acquisition, the promotion, the advocacy training, all that stuff, and the support.
Let's take a detour there. Do you think customers should be smarter and say, why am I need to reduce the cost of this product? And one way to do that is to stop needing so much sales effort. Stop demanding free stuff and unlimited engineers to come out and tell me. It's on me to take the responsibility for that and work out what I want. And then I wouldn't have to pay. I mean, products would be 30% cheaper if I didn't have to have so much sales cycle.
Two things. They have to have enough experience with different products to be able to do that. And so if you look at the salaries that big cloud companies pay for that sort of expertise, where they can amortize a decision on, do I do layer 3 or layer 2 as an overlay network, for example, they can amortize the cost of that very expensive small engineering and architecture team who can run some experiments to stay current, travel to the conferences. I think it's very difficult for most IT organizations to think about funding an advanced architecture group to do that sort of evaluation.
Or to not customize every deployment, or to fiddle around with it until it starts, like to use the shiny knobs and make it so that it's very difficult and complicated to buy.
There's certainly a lot of truth in that, but consider, for years I've gone to the RSA trade show conference, and the experts for the past 4 or 5 years all say, I can't figure this stuff out. I cannot tell the difference between all these companies. And so I think it's so difficult for enterprises to make evaluations. I think it's, in the grand scheme of things, yes, they can lower costs, but people costs and figuring out how to leverage time against pressing problems is very difficult for enterprises. And I think this is sort of the main reason why
cloud is so successful.
You're right. Cloud's sort of an easy way to outsource a significant chunk of that. Yeah. But it's also the case for the portion of IT that belongs inside. It's pretty easy for them. If they're happy with their current vendor, it's pretty easy for them to make a decision like that.
Which brings us to the question of you and I, as we had a call last week, and we're talking about different areas where I wanted to talk. And one of the topics that we came up with is, now you come from a LAN background, the 10 gig Ethernet by and large, or the local area network. And we were talking a little bit about how SD-WAN was, well, it was a bit of a surprise in a way. We didn't sort of predict that it was going to be coming. And yet, as soon as I heard about it, I was instantly realized just how quickly this was going to win compared to other types of technology, because the cost, you could just cut vast amounts of cost out of a WAN budget, which nobody wanted anyway. But the challenge I see is that the WAN is still seen radically different as it is from the data center or from the campus. But at the end of the day, it's got to come together as one, do you think? What's your thoughts on that?
I think so. But a colleague of mine drew a picture on a whiteboard that I'll give you the narration of. So the WAN and the LAN have some fundamental difference. If you're a LAN person and you go take a look at the WAN for the first time, what you will see is that the bandwidth is, for all practical purposes, zero. The cost is infinite, and the latency is infinite. And if the opposite happens, from the perspective of the WAN expert, the LAN, the cost is zero, the latency is zero, and the bandwidth is infinite. And so those differences, I think, lead to distributed systems and have led to this part, most of the driver for this conversation about what's the edge and how big is it going to be. It's going to be big. But I think it's absolutely true that common protocols have sort of forced conversations. I actually did a presentation to a local meetup group now about 4 or 5 years ago called All Clouds Are Made of Metal. And it was in reaction to the fact that when I go talk to a WAN person, they didn't understand that you could buy a 10 gig Ethernet NIC for under $1,000, because they were talking about $20,000 interfaces with broadband, long distance optical interfaces on them. That was sort of their frame of reference. But I think the fact that the protocols are now basically all IP has caused a lot of communication among the participants, I think, to the benefit of both sides about how to do this. And so I think there are important differences that are laws of physics differences.
But at a different layer, it's all still IP or Ethernet.
Right.
It's all VLANs. The switch to encapsulations over the WAN is a transition, but not a new one. We've been doing IPsec VPN since 2000, and then SSL VPN shortly after that, because we had to keep reinventing the wheel there. And the transition from overlay to a software operated overlay is not huge.
That's right.
When people have already been pre-configuring static overlays using IPsec or quasi-static overlays using a GET VPN or DM VPN, if you want to think about it like that. And everything else is the same. The only thing that's different, I think, is the latency and the bandwidth. So you could argue that, access lists, firewalls, services, monitoring is the same in the LAN as the WAN, like it never has been before. The gap between, the switches in the data center running x86 CPUs and the routers at the edge of the network running x86 CPUs, they run the same software or rapidly approaching the same Linux software. It's only the apps that are different now. There's a real opportunity to converge these into a single unified network, but while respecting the differences that you've highlighted.
I think that's true, but one question that I'm curious what you think. My reaction to why SD-WAN happened is the public internet got good enough. It got reliable enough and high enough performance that people said, wait a minute, I'm not sure I need my branch office on a dedicated MPLS pipe that I'm paying some service provider for. Is that what you see as the kind of the...
That's the first phase. So that's the connectivity. So I think people get very excited about the fact that I don't have to spend 3 months of lies from a carrier that they're definitely going to be installing a circuit, and then they don't. And then there's another 3 months of telephone calls and escalations. And then finally the telco sends the right person out to plug in a cable and boom, you've got your bandwidth. Mm-hmm. And 6 months later, there's problems. You've had your organization hates you and what you represent. They hate the vendor who sold them, all that sort of stuff. So I think, yes, I think the key factor of SD-WAN is you can start with 4G. If you had to, you could put in a pinch hit solution for day one. The branch is open. There's only going to be three or four people in there. And then you've got 6 weeks to get the rest of that provisioning done. And if needs be, you'll just run some broadband in. And then maybe you'll run a dedicated internet access at some point in the future. Now, whether that's a cable or whatever, it doesn't matter. You've got choices that you never had before. I think another factor here is people hate their telcos. And I don't think this is ever surveyed. Nobody ever asks this question. You won't see it in the analyst reports because the analysts are all beholden to the telcos, right? That's where a lot of the money comes from. So they're not going to ask a question of the people who buy this product and say, on a scale of 1 to 10, how much do you hate your telcos anonymously? Because the answer is going to be like 8.5. Right, because they overcharge, they fail to deliver, they never respond to help desk calls, they're never able to help you with your problems when you report them to them. Everybody, so I think there's that I call that the Oracle effect, if you like, because of Oracle systems. How many customers tell you how great Oracle is to your face, and when you take them out to the bar later, they'll tell you how much they're less than pleased about certain aspects of their Oracle relationship. And then the third one, I think, is, and this is the one that's just beginning to emerge, is that when everything's connected to the internet, you're permissionless. You can do anything. So now all of a sudden I can have branch breakout to the internet. But if I want to make that safe, I send it off to a cloud service and I log it all and inspect it all and filter it all and done. Now that's permissionless. I don't need my telco to get in the way of that. I don't need to ask them for permission. If I want to connect my head office from this company to that company and we're all connected to the internet, no more permission, no more raising a purchase order for a dedicated link and who's going to pay for the A end and the B end and who's going to own it and pay the... Do you remember all those discussions?
Sure.
So I think this permissionless networking is happening after the SD-WAN purchase. And then the fourth thing that I'll highlight here is that all of the SD-WAN solutions come with visibility and analytics tools. So you can see inside the application flow. So it's not the old plug a router in, IP packets flow, cross your fingers, right? And hope that the bandwidth doesn't saturate. Because if it does, there's nothing you can do because you have no idea what's flowing over the link. If somebody out in the branch office is suddenly streaming YouTube, you've got no way of knowing that without going back to the market and asking for more money and putting a tool in place to do that. Whereas SD-WAN, built in. After the purchase, that visibility and analytics is the thing that drives the next purchasing cycle to keep SD-WAN going. You don't see it pulling. There's a certain number of technologies that come to market and fail. And the thing that's pulling SD-WAN into the second phase of growth is these visibility and analytics of the applications going over the network.
That makes a lot of sense to me. But I want to take the other side of the argument for a moment. But one of the consequences is there are now 60-some suppliers and open source SD-WAN coming. And so this is an area of rapid dynamism, and people are now putting SD-WAN controllers and virtual machines and this impact on NFE and so forth. But I remember, so I was founding CEO of a company named Brightlink Networks, where we built the world's largest OEO switch in the 2000 era and went through lab trials with our poster child accounts, which were WorldCom and Global Crossing, the end of 2001, neither of which could rub two nickels together. So one of the key guys with deep experience in marketing to telcos said, you know, the only asset the telcos have is the copper in the ground. Well, they managed to work through the IP transition and they're delivering service. And the assets they now have, I think, are indeed the copper and fiber in the ground. And is support of that argument, look at what Google Fiber did, where several key people said from the telco side, they're going to figure out they can cover a few metro areas, but they don't have the capital. Even Google doesn't have access to capital to build the network. So there's that piece of the thing. I'll
take it a step further and say it's not even the copper and the fiber in the ground that matters. It's the right of way, the license they're issued by the government.
I think that's right. And particularly in the United States, there's another asset that AT&T and Verizon has that plays into this whole edge computing and where NFV takes place, which is they own central offices. And collectively, they're paying, how you count them, 15 to 25,000 central offices in the United States, which were located with a goal of being within 10,000 feet of a residence or a business.
Yeah, because that was the maximum run of a copper pair for a telephone. That's how far a current loop could run. Yeah.
The interesting thing is this discussion about, are we going to put containers next to towers and do real computing at the edge because of latency? Well, at a nanosecond a foot over copper and a nanosecond every 6/10 of a foot or so over fiber, the COs are close enough. And I think those are, the companies that have the COs, Verizon and AT&T, are advocating that that's where most of the computing is going to go. And the people who don't have COs, some service providers, some MVNOs, but definitely also the companies that own the towers that are trying to figure out how to monetize a piece of real estate rather than just rent antennas based to their carriers, are advocating computing at the tower. But I think the TCO is lower if you have fewer locations that are easier to get to when you have to actually make a truck roll. I think And the cost of air conditioning and that sort of stuff is going to be lower in a central office. We're going to have computing at the tower, but I think...
Yeah, we'll talk about whether telcos are actually capable of doing customized services. I mean, 10 years ago, Cisco, among other networking companies, put a lot of effort into doing video streaming over telco networks. And what we saw there was that in the end that Netflix took all the fun out of that. Nobody wants to listen to... You know, nobody wants to buy... television content or video content or entertainment. Let's break it back even simpler. Nobody wants to buy entertainment from the network they're connected to because that's so limiting. What they would rather have is an over-the-top provider like Netflix or now what Disney is building, like Hulu and so forth. And in the UK, the local providers here are building their own overlays. And the idea of doing video in the network makes no sense whatsoever. So the idea of just, these video content delivery networks that were going to be put into the CEOs failed completely and utterly. And I don't believe that the market mechanics, I think the technology has changed radically. We'll talk more, hopefully we'll get time to talk about containers and networking in a bit. But I think the technology that was available 10 years ago would have supported a video CDN, but then Netflix just went out and built its own CDNs. It has 10,000 POPs around the world today. Why would it want to do a deal with Verizon or AT&T to put their technology inside of those central offices and be beholden to them. It would rather be in open data centers that are properly provisioned with grown-up technologies like redundant power supplies and security, you know, physical security. A lot of those CEOs have zero security. Nobody's monitoring them. You know, they've got glass windows that someone could lob a brick through and then jump in and steal all the kit.
So I agree with that. I think what that translates to in the future is a recognition that there's a codependency between the cloud companies. And I kind of put Netflix as a cloud service provider. But I think there's a codependency between the cloud service providers that are going to have those kinds of services and the companies that own the infrastructure, the telcos. Mm. And so I don't think the telcos disappear, but I think you're exactly right, is they just don't move fast enough.
Well, it comes back to this permissionless thing too, right? I don't want to be,
exactly.
You know, when I don't have to turn to a third party to get permission to do the things that I want to do, things can happen that I don't. You know, if I want to quit Netflix and go and sign up for Hulu, I can. Or maybe I subscribe to both. Or if I want to, you know, use Zscaler but switch over to Cisco's umbrella because I want to, I can. I don't need to go and suddenly beg Verizon to install me a circuit, you know, or beg BT in the UK to install me a circuit so I can access their security thing. That's not what anybody wants anymore.
It may be a provocative statement, but I view this as having first happened when users got permission to set up their own phone call by putting a dial in the home.
Yes.
So it's a long cycle, but yeah, I think it's an interesting thing, and I personally would, you know, question does it really make sense for the telcos to own content generation, and time will tell whether that's a long term phenomenon or not.
So my view, again, just a perspective on that, is that every time the telcos get away from their core business of putting cable in the ground and then attaching equipment to the end of the cable to monetize that license that they were given, every time they do anything more than that, they fail. Data centers, telephony solutions, managed services, all of that stuff, they just, because their core business is so phenomenally large, the whole company gravitates around that dig hole, put cable in, attach thing to end to make packets flow over it so I can make money out of it. And anything else seems to be just breed incompetence inside of those organizations. Like, provably over the last 40 years, they've never been able to do anything more than that.
I think, yeah, certainly some worse than others, but I think in general that's the case.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, we're making gross generalizations. There are cases where, you know, some of these telcos will have a business unit that does quite well and then they'll sell it off, which has happened in any number of cases.
Yep.
So that sort of thing. So let's come back to containers and networking. We've touched on this a few times about this idea. We've seen the transition from bare metal to virtual machines to containers, and the networking that's in between all of these is still, well, I still think it's fairly immature. What's your thoughts there?
I think that's true, and what I see is a repeating pattern. So if you go back to the early connectivity of servers together, simple hubs to bridges to routers, high cost replaced by lower cost switching with VLANs, and now in silicon layer 3 networks. Virtual machines went through the same thing. Software bridges, real simple things, OVS, OpenStack went through a transition where they thought all they needed was simple networking until people said, wait a minute, we've got multiple tenants, we need firewalls and so forth. And to your point about security everywhere, I think we're headed to a point where every application server is going to have some sort of a firewall on it. So, and now here we are with containers. The people said, well, we don't need to worry about networking. We'll just do service mesh. And so now there's a movement to do network service mesh. And it's relatively immature in this cycle. And I think a lot of people who are deploying containers are doing so on top of VMs for the following reason. If you have a clean slate application, I've listened to presentations by PhDs hired by, for example, Tesla, who built a Kubernetes cluster for them. Well, this is sort of a clean slate application. But if you have legacy things, it's just so much more straightforward to put them in VMs. So I think VMs last a long time. And now we're talking, and people seriously deploying Kubernetes on top of virtual machines. And I talked to somebody from one of the big consultancies who's got sizable business with AT&T and other service providers who said, we spent a fair amount of time and money to make VMs work inside of containers, which I think has some merit. But so far, people don't want to do that. But yeah, I think we are in a period of both rapid change and relative immaturity. And people running things at scale. Anecdotally, I hear people are saying, well, you know, Envoy really is not very performant. It's really slow and it needs a lot of work yet. So I think we are kind of repeating the cycle, but I think the technologies are around for a long time. One of the interesting uses for containers, if you're trying to deploy software and embedded systems all over the planet, you can use a very lightweight Linux kernel with container support, never change it. And so you can upgrade your full OS running in a container with much, much more assurance. You're not going to have to go out and have somebody unplug and plug the machine in to reboot it because it's frozen during some upgrade.
Yeah, you're not going to have to power it off to reflash.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
I mean, I remember back in the day when there was all these custom file systems on the flash modules of network hardware. We don't have that today. We have all of these standardized file systems and standardized methods of booting these devices much more reliably. And the idea that you would need to change the underlying operating system is much – well, still requires some – occasionally you will need to patch the underlying operating system. But the idea that you can change the app and the operating system functions around
that's
the
right.
app quickly and at speed allows you to iterate. And this is one of the things that's driving SD-WAN is that a lot of the SD-WAN vendors are containerizing their apps, the SD-WAN apps, the things that do the inspection or the pathing or the analytics, and they can actually reboot, you know, upgrade those in the middle of the day. They don't need an outage window or an operational window because if something goes wrong, they just halt the container and roll back to the previous version. And it is quite seamless because the underlying, as you say, Linux operating system, which is pushing packets around the internals, is not changed.
So this is kind of an interesting segue to talk about what's going on with NFV, because it took a long time for Etsy, long time compared to the way the virtual machine world grew up. Etsy sort of finalized on a reference architecture, and then containers come along. And for the reasons you cite, people say, well, maybe we ought to abandon VMs and go to containers. And then overlay that with the phenomena that people are now figuring out that they're not going to get software for a whole lot cheaper. And it sort of goes back to my point about Oracle's cost of sales and marketing, is that for a company to do a competent job of any one of these load balancers, firewalls, application layer firewalls, whatever the virtual network function is, to do a competent version, there's a certain amount of engineering that has to be required. It has to be supported. It has to be marketed, demoed. People have to be able to understand how it fits in. And so there's a certain cost of that. And the incentives of the companies that were making nice margins on hardware appliances don't have much of an incentive to cannibalize their own business with radically different cost.
No, I've always wondered, you know, what you really want to see is like a subscription. You know, like if you click here and sign up, it's 50% cheaper. Like, I agree with you. I've seen Cisco's numbers and they're spending more than 50% of their gross revenue on marketing in one form or another. And that, the same thing's happening over at Nutanix. I think the number there is 60%. Palo Alto spending 6% of its gross revenue. Like Nutanix and Palo are both loss-making businesses because they spend so much money on sales. But the point here is, would there be a market for customers to be able to say, no, I don't want a salesperson. I just want to buy this from Amazon as seen. Does that work? Or I suspect the answer here is no, because it falls down because customers will just talk to the sales rep and then go and buy it from behind his back.
Well, it for sure incrementally works once somebody's at Amazon. So if you look at – so Amazon worked pretty hard to recruit startups at one point from the standpoint of, you know, even pitching to the VCs. Like, you know, tell your startup companies, don't spend their scarce capital on capital equipment. Just spend it with us. And so once you're there, it's pretty easy to add incremental services. Those numbers are starting to add up. And so there's now some pushback of that. But I think it absolutely works once you've got a platform like AWS where you can use to market and attract customers. I think it's pretty hard to get to enterprises. And because IT organizations are so spread thin, where they have initiatives around smart movement to the cloud, security, and what do we do about AI, machine learning, those sorts of technologies, business analytics, they don't have much time to evaluate vendor A versus vendor B.
Well, and they don't need to because the cloud's got one of something.
That's right.
Have five of them or 10 of them, and you don't need help to select it. You either buy it or you don't, and the billing comes one way. you know, you don't get, and you don't get to haggle. This is the price. Until you get to a certain point at which that, you know, it is possible to get somebody from Amazon around the room and have a good old haggle. But my point has been to discuss this several times on the podcast over the last couple of years is that there's a cost in haggling. If you spend 100 hours in meetings with vendors and you put 10 people in the process, that's nearly $250,000.
That's exactly right. But if you're a big customer, you know,
yes,
you get different pricing. No question about it.
Well, yes. So I just I think there's a feature here where people at a certain, but at the flip side of it is, of course, if you did that, if you just said go and buy your stuff off Amazon for and here's the price, click hard, you know, if you press twice, you get two of the same thing. The price doesn't change just because you bought 10 of them. I wonder how much simpler life would be for the ordinary person if they just knew the prices was fixed and there wasn't, you know, any need to waste time haggling. Like a Monty Python skit. But anyway, and maybe just something I can discuss another time.
Yeah, we're going to pause our podcast discussion for a word from our sponsor today, IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV, they are flexible, online, technical training. Why training? Training helps you take advantage of the career paths that are available in IT, and IT has an incredibly strong career path right now. A recent MIT study shows that IT occupations have grown by nearly 20% between 2004 and 2017. That is more than 8 times the growth rate of other career paths. Earnings are growing for folks in IT as well, even though earnings are flat for college grads on the average. IT Pro TV can help you take advantage of these IT career trends with courses covering CompTIA and Cisco and EC Council, VMware, and lots more. There are over 4,000 hours of binge-worthy, on-demand training content out there for you. The hosts that are presenting the information, they're doing it in engaging, a talk show kind of a format to keep you paying attention. And they're live every day if you like live content, but then that live content goes studio to web in 24 hours so you can stream it whenever you're ready. Courses are conveniently listed by category, certification, and job role so you can find what you're looking for without a lot of headache. You can stream the courses, of course, live or again on demand via any method you're looking for. Chromecast, Roku, Amazon Fire TV, Apple TV, PC, their iOS or Android apps. You got all those sorts of choices. And the big idea here, make it easy to learn your stuff, then go pass your exams, earn your certs, and then land your next great job with the help of training from IT Pro TV. So how do you do it? Visit itpro.tv/packet to take advantage of their lowest prices ever. That's itpro.tv/packet. itpro.tv/packet. And when you use the code PACKET25 at checkout, you will save an additional 25% off your membership for the lifetime of your active subscription. Just be sure to use that code PACKET25 at checkout. That is PACKET25. And we thank them for sponsoring the podcast. And now back to the show.
So you think containers are great mainly as a packaging tool?
I think they have other value, but because the underlying the individual functions have to be qualified in the same OS and patch level, I think there's some natural combinations of virtual machines with containers running on top of them that I think are going to be pretty popular. But I think there's one other factor, which is it sort of goes back to Moore's law. If you look at what's happening to servers, we now have GPUs after 15 years of evangelizing, GPUs are being accepted by enterprises as a part of their IT infrastructure for machine learning models and stuff like that. And so I think it's an example of an offload processor. And I think Intel is affected more than anybody by Moore's law because they have really added transistors to chips and they're struggling to add more transistors. I think they're more affected by that than, for example, RISC processors are. So I think we're headed to a new era of offload processors, which creates an opportunity. I think you're going to see in the future single socket x86 machines with lots of offload cards, GPUs,
TPUs,
ML chips,
network processing units.
That's right. And I think network processing is maybe the most interesting because it hasn't really been attacked yet. And a variety of companies have got intelligent offload processors that I think, unlike the prior generations, which were sort of almost fads because they were introduced, TCP was offloaded, or some function, it was TOE was the acronym in the 10 gig and Gigeri Air for TCP offload engines. Because of Moore's Law and because of the challenges Intel has in adding transistors to Xeon processors, I think this is going to be a long-term phenomenon that offload processors of a variety of types.
Well, we've seen Intel make a number of purchases in this area. They just recently purchased Barefoot Networks with their with the Tofino. Last time they purchased an ASIC company like that, they turned it into a chip that went on the motherboard before it passed off to be a fancy NIC. And so there is a pathway for that. And I also think that we've already seen the TPU and the GPU thing, but we're also seeing the Optane, like the persistent SRAM type model, the persistent memory, which is the three-dimensional NAND type products that are coming to market. They're not quite as fast as DRAM. They're only 10 times slower than DRAM, but they're still 1,000 times faster than SSDs.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's another processor offload function that I see.
And there's talk about computational storage, which is the idea of saying, decouple this from the server. And I think these modern sort of SoCs that are being created by the companies in the NIC business potentially could turn into microservers in a new form. Hmm. And maybe if you think about the footprint of a 40-watt PCI Express card, for example, if you can run, kind of make up the math, I don't think anybody makes one this size, but if you imagine a 10-core RISC processor, ARM, for example, 10-core ARM.
Yeah, no, quite a few of the NIC makers, I won't mention names today, but are running 16 ARM CPUs.
Yeah. So when those have clock rates of 2 to 3 gigahertz, they can be treated as microservers and run real workloads.
Sure. And today they're basically functioning. Each ARM CPU becomes a thread on the NIC. So you can feed network flows into them and they can perform quite sophisticated computation. But as you say, they are, you know, low speed, low powered ARMs because you've only got a 40 watt profile. But yeah, I agree. I think the offload. So this type of offload then, does that drive into service function chaining? We've seen service function chaining come and go. And at this point in time, I basically believe it's dead. I don't think it's going to go forward. So let's have a discussion around that.
I think that's likely, but I think you could imagine if I could build a modern blade server with these PCI cards that have 10 or so cores of higher performance ARM, you know, the high core count, low performance things are kind of aimed at network function. But I think you're going to see gadgets with 2 to 3 gigahertz processors that are treated like Linux servers. And so now I think it's possible to either package these as a high-end CPE or put these in a chassis as sort of a modern alternative to ATCA because it's all off-the-shelf PCI Express cards, combine it with video processing. So I think you're going to see combinations at the edge that will allow affordably people to either have on-premise or hosted in towers if you like, or hosted in COs where you can afford to have at least one of these per customer with a tiny footprint of a PCI Express card, nominally 40 watts.
Imagine, I think that what just struck me as you were talking about that is imagine a PCI Express card with 4 to 16 iPhone chips on it, right?
Yeah.
Which is an ARM CPU, right?
And yeah, exactly.
An iPhone has a very high-speed CPU and a GPU and a TPU and quite a few other things as well, security chips, hard, you know, TPMs, a whole bunch of things in there. Well, you could get, you know, if you took the battery and everything, you take away all the extraneous bits of that, you could easily put a half a dozen of those on a PCI card if you could find a market for it.
So I think that's exactly right. But I think also you're going to need high speed 25, 50, 100 gig Ethernet. Mm. And the companies that I think are best positioned to do that are the companies that are currently in the NIC business.
I agree. I mean, we're just spitballing here. This is just idea. But the idea, you know, that you have computers inside your computers.
So if you could do that and you went to the service providers and say, you know what, we're going to give you the benefit of that physical to virtual conversion to dramatically reduce the size of the footprint. So you don't need a 1 or 2U rack mount appliance per function. You can put it on a PCI Express card, pick a chassis. They're available off the shelf in some form already today, and give them the ability to run a small number of containers, maybe on a per customer basis, or more than one per customer, depending on the application. I think that could fairly quickly. I say fairly quickly. These things are, you know, 5 to 10 year cycles, but I think that may be the way this sort of rolls out, and I think it's a way out for the incumbent vendors that are making appliances. I think they're going to end up adopting these kinds of things. And it's just sort of grown up. And I think the interesting thing is that the RISC processors in terms of MIPS per transistor are far ahead of Intel. And so they're not going to hit the Moore's Law wall for a while.
No, there's a lot of innovation to be had here. Intel recently bought a company which does chiplets, which is something that's in between an ASIC and a CPU, which is there's a whole bunch of perhaps
multi-chip carrier of some kind, basically. Yeah,
yeah. There's quite a few of them around. Broadcom has some chiplets and stuff like that, and I don't know what that's going to look like in the end. I want to come back to the idea of networking in a service function chain, and there's a bunch of standards working their way through the ITF. And I wonder, the idea that is that behind service function chaining is that you would have when it started out, it was going to be VMs, and you're going to steer traffic flows between each one. So if you wanted to go, you know, firewall, IDS, WAF, logging, analytics, and you would say this flow takes this path through the network, and it would program all of the way stations and the service functions in the middle. What struck me recently is that the fact that we've actually been very effective with microsegmentation, so SD-WAN, software-defined data center, now we're seeing the emergence of the software-defined campus. What you're effectively driving there is microsegmentation. If I've got a sufficient incumbent products in the market around microsegmentation, maybe I just don't need to steer flows. I just need microsegmentation and say a container with a firewall, a container with a WAF, a container with, and it's all just part of one microsegment and some basic routing, and boom, away it goes. Would that not be cheaper and easier?
It makes a lot of sense to me, and I think the adoption's pretty simple. But I think there's another repeat cycle of a phenomena we've seen before. You went to a single vendor, pick a large incumbent that says, we're going to build one management framework and provisioning. And as an aside, I can no longer describe to people the difference between an orchestrator, a management system, and a controller, because there have been some vertical integration of those. But a vendor like Cisco that says, manage all of your Cisco stuff with one common pane of glass, consistent UI, and so forth. So that's been sort of one approach. And it hasn't just been Cisco. It's been lots of big vendors have done this over many, many decades. And there always has been another view that says, buy a Swiss neutral management framework that works multi-vendor to avoid lock-in of management. And so I think there are opportunities for both camps. There are going to be companies that say, okay, I'm going to manage my Cisco infrastructure with a Cisco UI. Ericsson or Nokia, same kind of thing. But I also think the opportunity, and VMware certainly fits in that camp as well. And I think they're a serious player, obviously, in SD-WAN. But I also think there are opportunities for independent management frameworks that are vendor neutral. And you're going to be able to drill down where you need to do low-level configurations. And so
I can see that. And I thought in the early days that you would always have to have the controller bound to the device. So the SDN controller would be at the top and then the bottom would be a device. But what we're also seeing is SDN controllers of various ilks, you know, pick your favorite flavor, able to manage any device in the forwarding plane. So it's not beyond the pale that some orchestration system might have Cisco over and may even start to do what I call SDN federation. So you have a mother controller talking to a daughter controller, and the daughter controller comes from vendor B, and the mother controller comes from vendor A, and then below that is, you know, vendor B's networking assets down the bottom. So if you can have a combination of Cisco and Palo and Checkpoint and Zscaler devices in your net, you know, whatever it is that you're going to use, and they're all orchestrating those together because they're all talking to each other about configuration data and status, and but within their own zone of functionality, they're proprietary, but the controllers themselves talk to some other controller or some sort of consensus system in the middle.
You stated it more articulately than I did, but I think that's exactly right. And I think so what are the interface layers? Well, REST is sort of a really general notion, but REST interfaces have certainly a play here. There are some other things. For as much as OpenFlow is criticized, it's sort of the way you talk to OVS, which is very popular.
More popular than people know. Everybody likes to say OpenFlow doesn't work, but funny.
I got a chuckle out of a former Google engineer when I described P4 as OpenFlow 2.0, and he chuckled. He said, "That's exactly what it is."
I remember having a conversation with someone from, I think it might have been Nick McEwen, and he sort of went, "Somewhat."
And so now Broadcom, I think, and I just saw a headline in June, they announced something called NPL. So they're starting to show off. And it's open source, free. Remains to be seen which of these are going to be successful. But I think that's sort of an intermediate language to describe what you want the network to do makes this whole notion easier, that people can kind of stitch together pieces. Various levels of abstraction here. So I think that's an important area, but very, very early still.
I do think service function chaining might have missed it. We might have passed it by with microsegmentation, software operated microsegmentation, and the analytics and blah, blah, blah. And the service function chaining stuff may not get critical mass because microsegmentation is near enough and we've got plenty of pre-existing tools, which it's a lot easier just to use those than to try and develop SFC.
I think it's a different situation, a little bit related. People are now seriously talking about moving to 5G is not a whole new network, but upgrading portions of their existing infrastructure on 4G, capitalizing on different backhaul technologies that already exist, taking advantage of in-building Wi-Fi. I think more of an ant farm style evolution than rip and replace.
Okay, so I think we kind of agree that service function chaining, the future for that is a little uncertain, maybe microsegmentation. And I think that the other piece about microsegmentation or service function chaining is that most of the work is actually organizing the functions, not the networking part. Right now, the problem here is where's the firewall? What does the firewall do? What's an access list? What's security scanning? And there's a lot of work there. The networking stuff will end up probably just being microsegmentation because by the time they solve those problems, they'll go like, I'm very tired of this now and I just need to make money and ship it and it'll just end up being some half-assed thing, which seems realistic to me.
I think that's exactly right. Somebody coined the term function as a service. The balance of how much gets outsourced, how much of the control is done in the cloud, I think people are starting to settle into patterns that work.
Well, on that note, I think we've hit all the topics we wanted to cover and we're starting to run out of the available time. Harry, thank you so much for joining today. It's been a really fun conversation for me. I hope it has been for you.
I've enjoyed it.
Yeah. And thank you for making the time. Where can people find you on the internet? Do you want them to find you or do you like doing what you're doing in secrecy?
I'm always interested in talking to people with interesting product ideas, for example, or service ideas. And so they can find me in my LinkedIn profile or harry@quackenboss.com is my email address.
And if you want to find out more about the show, we do actually have a website and there's a bunch of show notes. There's actually not going to be much here, but we'll list out the topics that we played through the show and you can actually have a look at what we thought we were going to talk about and maybe think about what we did talk about because everything's always organic and fluid here at the Packet Pushers. As always, thank you for listening to us on the packetpushers.net. We have thousands of other episodes across our podcast network for you, including shows like the IPv6 Buzz, which just talks about IPv6. We have Day 2 Cloud, which is a new and emerging podcast just talking about cloud topics, and there's much more there for you beyond just this fine but excellent heavy networking show with Harry today. As always, you can follow us on Packet Push at Packet Pushers on Twitter. We're on LinkedIn. If you could rate us on Apple Podcasts, that would be a great help. And don't forget our membership site over at ignition.packetpushers.net. And as always, remember that too much networking would never be enough.